Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it is the Serpentine Hour here on Weird House Cinema, because today, Rob, am I right that this is our first snake movie?
It is. I mean, we've certainly had some snakes and even killer snakes pop up in some of our Florida movies that we did, including Zat and Frogs, but Venom is going to be our first true snake movie.
Now, this movie is called Venom, but no, it's not that Venom. No, it's not that other one either. This is Venom 1981, the original Venom.
Or, well, one of the original Venoms. I noticed that there are multiple films with the title Venom. So I'm not sure if this one is the true originator, but it's the one that we're talking about here today.
Man, I love a good snake romp. A snake movie really, it just gets you by the gut sometimes. So I love, as we've discussed before, the campy supernatural pleasures of the Lair of the White Worm to even what I would argue is maybe the best creature feature of all time, the 1997 Amazon snake hunt movie Anaconda, in which the cardinal rule of great snake movies is observed, and this is what I would argue the rule is: any creature movie featuring an unusually large or unusually deadly reptile must also contain at least one human actor who is more reptilian than the creature itself. Now, in the case of Anaconda, you've got your giant CGI reptile, but it is being constantly upstaged by John Voight, delivering one of the most bizarre performances I have ever seen in any movie. You just look at him, you can tell his blood is room temperature. When he blinks his eyes, they go horizontal. And his accent is just radioactive weirdness. He sounds like he's trying to sort of be Peter Lorre doing a like Spanish Count Dracula kind of thing, but also as a ruthless jungle poacher with a ponytail. So that movie definitely adheres to the rule, but I think today's pick also observes the rule.
That's right. Venom is a very interesting film, in large part because it features not one, but two notoriously difficult actors, Oliver Reed and Klaus Kinski. And there's actually another reportedly difficult actor in this as well. So you can really up that to three, but it's especially evident with Reed and Kinski based on some of the stories and the fact that they share a lot of screen time in this film. So you can imagine if they were constantly shouting at each other and almost coming to blows, it would have been a particularly terrible working environment for everyone on the picture.
You can feel the bad vibes through the screen.
Yes. Now, I mean, luckily, they're both playing villains, and the characters are also supposed to somewhat hate each other. So on the screen, setting aside anything we know about the making of and these actors themselves, you know, it ends up working. But yeah, both Kinski and Reed were kind of larger than life figures. Both were noted hedonists in their own ways, and they were both highly talented actors whose careers were damaged by their difficult behavior. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, at the very least, they were both very problematic figures.
Well, if you're talking about their personal lives, I think especially in the case of Kinski, that's sort of an understatement.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I feel like every time I learn something new about Kinski, I regret it. Now, we're not going to focus, I guess, too much on their personal lives, but, I admit that I don't necessarily have the stomach for too much of that sort of thing. But, you know, some argue that Reed sort of played up this Hellraiser image for the press, though there seems no denying his alcoholism and his also kind of like brute macho demeanor. Kinski, on the other hand, was prone to outbursts and tantrums, it seems, and seems to have suffered from mental illness. He also was apparently just reviled by many people who had to work with him. And I think Werner Herzog kind of stands apart as really the only filmmaker to have been able to work with him multiple times for a total of five different films. It's interesting to me, though, that Kinski played a vampire in two different Nosferatu films. And Reed played a werewolf in one Hammer film. So, to a large extent, we have vampires versus werewolves in this movie and behind the scenes on this movie. The vampire and the werewolf really do seem like monstrous reflections of the individual energies of these two actors.
Okay, so we know we're dealing with Klaus Kinski and Oliver Reed, both in a snake movie. But the weird thing is, it's not just a snake movie. Really, what this is a genre hybrid. This is a realistic crime thriller plus snake.
Yes. Another elevator pitch I might give it is a deadly game of cat and mouse, but mostly snake.
Yeah.
Or Home Alone, but with snake.
All good ways of summing it up. Another way you could sum it up is bad at crime, good at dying by snake.
Yeah, the bad at crime note is good. And this is one of those where those films where the criminal enterprise is perhaps not entirely well thought out, or mistakes are made that just lead to catastrophe. So it's in a way it's more in sort of the Fargo realm of crime cinema. Like these are guys who really screw up and make mistakes that are just catastrophic for their venture.
I also want to note that in terms of boo mechanics, I think there are basically two kinds of snake movies. So you could have like a big snake movie and a stealth snake movie. Mm-hmm. So big snake movies would be more like Anaconda. They focus on the scale of snake in order to intimidate. And this is either by having a single very large snake or by having a large quantity of regular sized snakes. But your stealth snake movies have a snake instead that is regular sized, maybe especially deadly, but it hides in places you don't expect and pops out at you. And this is a film in the latter camp. This is a stealth snake movie. This is a movie about opening up the liquor cabinet and oops, there's a black mamba and it bit you on the face.
Mm-hmm.
Though it would be hilarious to try to imagine doing the same premise as this movie, like a realistic crime thriller involving a kidnapping plot plus snake, with like a giant snake or a million snakes.
Yeah. I guess you could do a million snakes. It could be like the a million snakes are set loose in the house. I mean, isn't Snakes on a Plane essentially that? It's like there's something else going on, right? It's not just snakes on the plane. Isn't there like a hostage scenario or something?
Can I confess something? I've never seen all of Snakes on a Plane. I started watching it and never finished it.
I have to assume there's something else going on besides snakes. So
Yeah, I think there is a perfunctory crime element. Like somebody, it's like a witness in a mob case or something is being transported on a plane. But I would say snakes on a plane goes big snake, because the issue is there are many snakes on the plane.
This film with the single snake threat, it reminds me a lot of the Sherlock Holmes adventure, the adventure of the speckled band, which concerns like a very deadly venomous snake that is responsible for a death. And I wouldn't be surprised if that was ultimately one of the inspirations on this story.
Well, I think it's got a lot of actors who were in Sherlock Holmes movies and TV series in Britain, right?
Yeah. We have more than one Sherlock Holmes connection here for sure. Well, let's go ahead and jump right into the trailer here.
Venom. The kidnap that became a murder, that became a siege, that became a death trap. Venom. The fear explodes, trapping both hostages and kidnappers in its grip. The panic spreads, sending an entire police force into action. But this is a terror unlike anything anyone has ever faced. And when it uncoils to strike, your blood will run cold. Venom. Whatever you feel, you will fear. Venom.
Dude, this is classic creature feature narration, trailer narration. I absolutely love it. What does he say? Venom, the kidnap that became a murder, that became a siege, that became a death trap. Venom.
Yeah, they do a really good job of selling this movie in that trailer.
Uh-huh. And he also says this line I kept thinking about. I was like, what does it mean? He says, whatever you feel, you will fear. Does that mean that... Once you start thinking about snakes, like anytime something touches your body, I don't know, you brush against the door frame as you're walking through it, or I don't know, like a leaf falls on your shoulder, you're always going to think it's a snake?
I guess so. If we're being generous, I guess that's maybe what the ad copy here is trying to say.
What else would it mean? That's a weird line.
Whatever you feel, you will fear. I don't know. It doesn't really make much sense within the context of the film. Like,
yeah, I feel happy. Oh no!
Maybe it was the directing of the actors. They just said, like, they're like, well, what's my character? What's my motivation? And the director says, I don't know. Whatever you feel, you'll fear. And they're like, okay, because it does seem like for the most part, a lot of these actors were just kind of turned loose to just do their thing with the character. And there's not really necessarily a great sense of who the underlying character is supposed to be.
Do you remember, how did you come across this movie? What's the origin story here?
I have a couple of different Blu-rays of just trailers from like the 70s and 80s, and I was watching a compilation, and this one popped up, and I was like, oh, now this looks interesting.
I suspected that, because this is very much one where if you see the trailer, you're like, yep, okay, gotta see that one.
Well, let's jump right in and talk about the various humans and the snakes involved in this film. So the director is Piers Haggard, born 1939. Interestingly enough, Toby Hooper was going to direct this picture originally, and I think may have been working on it a little bit, but then he had to bow out for some reason, and I think there are varying accounts as to why. And then enters Haggard here, who had previously directed the 1971 British horror film The Blood on Satan's Claw, A Divorce, The Quartermass Conclusion, also the Peter Sellers comedy, The Fiendish Plot of Dr. Fu Manchu, which everyone seemed to hate in 1980, and it's still very much hated today, seemingly with good reason. And he also directed various TV episodes. He went on to do more TV and a potentially interesting-looking sci-fi film titled The Life Force Experiment in 1994.
Oh, that's interesting.
Another interesting thing about him is he was dialogue assistant on the 1966 film Blow Up.
So he did The Life Force Experiment, and he came in to direct a movie that Toby Hooper was going to direct, and Toby Hooper directed Life Force.
Right. I don't know that there's any connection between Life Force and The Life Force Experiment, but certainly the names are similar. Now, this is an adaptation of a novel, it's worth stressing. the original novel Venom was written by Alan Schofield, who lived 1931 through 2017, a South African author who I think lived most of his life in England. I think he was like London based or something. But this book came out in 1977, and it still seems to be in print. You can go obtain this book and read it. I've never read any of his novels, but he was quite prolific. He also wrote a 1981 horror novel called Cat's Eyes under the name Lee Jordan. And it seems like he was reasonably well regarded and often worked African history and culture into his works. Apparently best known for his McCrae and Silver novels, which were London-based detective books. Now, the screenplay was written by Robert Carrington, born 1928, who wrote such films as Wait Until Dark and Fear is the Key, and he was active in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. All right, let's move on to the actors. So, our reptilian humanoid in this film is, of course, Klaus Kinski, who lived 1926 through 1991. He plays the character Jacmel.
So this is one of our main trio of criminals.
Yes. I guess he's kind of the mastermind. He's supposed to be. I think it mentions at one point that he's a member of the German underworld. He's like a German underworld figure, and he is of course flown in to London to mastermind this sort of. I'm not sure if he's the mastermind or not, but anyway, he's going to be one of the main operatives in this kidnapping plot.
I think he's played as the mastermind because there are a lot of scenes of him pointing a gun at Oliver Reed and being like, remember, you know, you don't drink whiskey until I tell you to.
All right. So Kinski, of course, a German-born actor, perhaps best remembered today for his smoldering presence in some of Werner Herzog's best-known works, such as Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Wojciech, Nosferatu the Vampire, Fitzcarraldo, and Cobra Verde. He also had a small but memorable role in Dr. Zhivago in 1965. And accounts of anyone who had to work with Kinski, they tend to revolve around two different things. His raw talent, that undeniably, like, there's something electric in a Klaus Kinski performance, but also intense difficulty and displeasure of working with him. It seems to be a common theme. Herzog managed it, but also had a just legendarily explosive relationship with Kinski. And at times, from stuff I've watched, documentaries and so forth, it seems like he was able to get the best stuff out of Kinski by sort of manipulating him, like, for instance, wearing him out with takes. In the case of Aguirre, Kinski has this monologue at the end of it, and Kinski thought he needed to rage through it, and Herzog reportedly just had him do it over and over again until he was just worn out and could only deliver it at the energy that Herzog wanted. I thought that was an insightful story about working with Kinski.
It seems like he was raging a lot.
Yes. Certainly behind the scenes. So Kinski did a number of spaghetti westerns as well, including For a Few Dollars More, as well as various European genre films. He played a vampire in Herzog's 1979 Nosferatu film, as well as the 1988 film Vampire in Venice. This was supposed to, I think, be a sequel to Nosferatu in some respects, but Kinski reportedly refused to wear any vampire makeup for it, and so he doesn't look like Nosferatu in it, per se. After a career of butting heads with various directors, he finally directed himself in 1989's Paganini, which he also wrote, and this was his final film. Now, a couple of interesting facts. Allegedly, Kinski turned down the role of Major Tot in Raiders of the Lost Ark because he hated the script, and Venom is the picture he did instead.
Oh, both snake-centric movies.
Yeah. And of course, Ronald Lacey wound up doing the character of Major Tot, which I think he's so great in it. This is the best thing that could have happened. As for Kinski's performance in Venom here, I'd say he's what we see on the screen is very good. He's menacing. He exudes evil, very much plays to his strengths. Though there is a scene where he has to fight a rubber snake, and let's be honest, that's a tall order for any actor.
I think his snake wrestling scene is a highlight of the film, especially because it turns into a gunfight with a snake.
Yes. Yep. A lot. Yep. it's a great climax.
You just wouldn't think that if a snake is wrapping around you and you're trying to fight it off, the solution you would come to is trying to shoot the snake in the head with a pistol.
Right. Yeah, it's a wonderful scene. Though I think Herzog could have gotten a better take out of him. He was just like worn him down till he got the right energy.
Okay, so Kinski is playing our like lead reptilian criminal in this, but then we've also got a more brutal criminal.
Right, that is Dave the Chauffeur, played by Oliver Reed. Oliver Reed lived 1938 through 1999. English actor with piercing eyes. Really, his as far as like eyes first acting goes, Reed was a master of this. You know, just sitting there smoldering and looking at you with murder eyes.
Oh, he uses the murder eyes in this film. Part of the problem, though, is like there's really not any surprise as the plot is revealed, because we first see Oliver Reed, I don't know, 30 seconds into the film, just acting in his capacity as a chauffeur, and he already looks like he is not just getting ready to do murders, but has already done them. He looks like he just came back in a hurry from doing murders.
Yes, absolutely. He always had a knack for playing brute macho characters. And of course, he increasingly earned a reputation for hell raising, drinking, and being difficult to work with. He had his first big leading role in the Hammer film, The Curse of the Werewolf, from Terence Fisher, that came out in 1961. And he landed some huge roles in such films as 1968's Oliver, in which he plays the villain Bill Sykes. He played Athos in Three Musketeers in 73 and its sequel in 74. And he continued to do a lot of villain roles and roles in horror films. He worked with Ken Russell several times, including Women in Love and, of course, The Devils, in which he really delivers a memorable performance. He played the god Vulcan in Terry Gilliam's The Adventures of Baron Munchausen in 88. Other notable roles, at least to me, include Disney's Condor Man in 1981, in which he plays this the villain in this ridiculous kind of superhero James Bond kind of film. He plays he's the hero in David Cronenberg's The Brood.
He is not the hero.
He's not the hero?
No,
I guess I've forgotten most of that film. He's the villain? He's the manipulating psychiatrist,
sort
right?
Sort of, yeah.
The psychologist?
Yeah, he plays an unorthodox psychiatrist who has like a retreat where he leads people through these strange exercises and gets them to sort of like turn their psychic pain and trauma into like physical external manifestations. So like, he leads people through these exercises where like their pain is turned into, in the case of one character, like a physical tumor, but in the case of other characters, like literal, like little, like beings or monsters that run around. The Brood is a gross movie. Be forewarned if you're going to venture there.
Yeah, Samantha Egger is in that, and I have to look it up. Let's see what Oliver Reed's character's name. What was his weird Cronenbergian character? Dr. Hal Raglan. Not that weird as far as Cronenberg names go.
My memory is just that he's like a weird sort of unethical, unorthodox psychiatrist who's doing a combination of something like, you know, like Scientology auditing alongside like creating tulpas and stuff.
Okay. Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen that one. Oh, we should also mention Oliver Reed was, of course, in Ridley Scott's Gladiator in 2000, and this was his final film. He died during the filming of it in Malta, I believe. Now, here's a fun fact. Venom is not the only Oliver Reed snake movie. He also appeared in 1983's Spasms alongside Peter Fonda. And this one, Joe, is a giant snake movie.
Okay, big snake instead of stealth snake.
Yeah. So, you can look up various stories about the production of Venom. Basically, yeah, Reed and Kinski famously did not get along on the film, reportedly hated each other, and Reed allegedly kept intentionally setting Kinski off, which sounds absolutely dreadful. You know, you already have Kinski, who is, has a reputation for being...
Satan.
Yes, Satan. And then you have Oliver Reed provoking Satan and, like, pranking Satan, and, you know, just to get a rile out of him. So, yeah, this sounds absolutely dreadful for everybody else in the production. That being said, much like we said with Kinski, Reed, I feel like he's good in this. I don't know... I feel like at times maybe they weren't sure exactly who this character was supposed to be. Sometimes he just seems to be like loud and abusive because he needed to do something in the scene. But also, I guess the better parts of the performance, they drive home that this is a guy who, yes, has signed on to be part of a kidnapping plot, but also has misgivings about it. And there are times where you see like maybe his gentler nature shine through just a little bit, as if to give you hope that he might turn good guy and strangle Klaus Kinski's character, Jacques Mel. Though, of course, that doesn't come to pass. He remains a bad guy throughout.
Yeah, never really has the face turn. Mainly, you get the idea that the moments where he's showing misgivings are actually just like, man, it would be bad to go to prison. I don't want that.
Yeah. He doesn't have a true change of heart. I will say this as well, though. Reed has a wonderful mustache in this film. Often he had wonderful mustaches, and this is no exception.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But actually, the star power in the movie doesn't really stop there with the criminals, because this movie has a number of other actors who are well known and quite respected. This is something I remember. I watched the Siskel and Ebert review of this movie, in which Ebert did not like it, but Siskel did. And
oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah. You know, occasionally Gene Siskel, you could see there was like a ridiculous creature horror movie, and you could just tell he just kind of liked it and had a hard time explaining why, but he just liked it. And he just wanted to be like, yeah, yeah, I thought Wes Craven's Shocker, it was fun. You know, it was interesting. Maybe it's not interesting, but you liked it. Come on, admit you liked it. And he, I don't know why I'm talking like that, because he did. He recommended it on the show. And he did with, like, I think he also liked Roger Corman's Carnosaur and stuff like that. So occasionally he just had a soft spot for creature films. But one thing that a lot of critics talked about was how, wow, you really got an A-level cast in this movie. And so the casting goes on with Sterling Hayden.
Yeah. Sterling Hayden, oftentimes it looks like he has top billing. I don't know why I don't really know how billing order goes, and especially over the decades of a film that's come out. But Sterling Hayden plays Grandpa Howard Anderson, AKA Grandpa Safari. That's what I kept thinking of him as. This guy was a big name.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, Sterling Hayden, he was in, he was a villain in The Godfather. He plays a corrupt police chief who is helping one of the other families with their schemes.
Mm-hmm.
He gets shot in the forehead by Al Pacino.
Yes, in that very memorable scene in the restaurant, right?
Yeah, yeah. But he also plays a great villain role in Dr. Strangelove. He plays General Jack D. Ripper. He's the guy who initiates the sneak attack on the Soviet Union that sets off the whole chain of events on the plot, because he has quite clearly consumed a lot of anti-communist propaganda and lost his mind. He's the character who believes that fluorination is stealing our precious bodily fluids.
He was also in Asphalt Jungle. He was in Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye. Now, he lived 1916 through 1986, and this was his last feature film role, but it capped off a long career full of a lot of leading man roles, especially Westerns and noir films. I was not prepared to enjoy his performance as much as I did, but I feel like he's a lot of fun as Grandpa Safari here, in part because maybe it comes down to the fact that I do feel like most of the actors in this film were just kind of turned loose in the house, much like a wild beast, and just like do whatever. And I like the strange energy he brings to this performance at times.
I agree. So the other two characters we've talked about already are criminals and bring a lot of menace. Grandpa Safari here is he's just like a big old ball of fun. He plays this character like an old rough and tumble rascal.
Yeah, and also, I mean, he's the grandpa, and the grandson is one of the main characters there. And, like, the grandson seems to suffer from some severe form of asthma, which requires the house to be at a constant 75 degrees, and he has to have, like, a humidifier. And his mom seems very much of the mindset, like, he needs to be kept in the house. But grandpa's like, oh, what you need, son, I'm going to get you a cab ride across town to buy yourself a new snake.
Uh-huh.
Get to do it all by yourself.
Yep.
And, of course, that becomes central to the plot.
Now, maybe we should specify in the plot that there is a mix-up. Grandpa did not buy his grandson a Black Mamba on purpose.
Yeah, I thought that's where it was going, because I knew that a Black Mamba was going to be introduced into the house. And I was like, oh, man, Grandpa's, this is a bit reckless. It was supposed to be a normal, like, non-venomous snake, some sort of acceptable pet species. And there is a mix-up.
But the A-list cast continues.
Yes, because we've talked about the criminals. We also have to have a representative of law and order. And in this case, we have Scotland Yard's Commander William Bullock, played by Nicol Williamson, who lived 1936 through 2011. I knew him best. I think a lot of listeners, a lot of viewers of films would probably know him best as Merlin in the endlessly shiny 1981 Camelot film Excalibur, which is a super fun performance, as I remember.
I've never seen it.
Oh, it's good. It's very shiny. Like the armor gleams, like it's, you know, it's reflecting the light of the sun at all times. So it's very stylish and has a wonderful cast. He also plays a similar role in 1997 Spawn. He plays this character, Cagliostro, who's kind of like, I think basically portrayed as like a wizard character that helps Spawn, helps him fight demons, trains him or something. He's kind of his mentor character. His final film role.
He's kind of like does he wear like a cowboy hat and a coat kind of?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, they wanted him to grow a beard and he's like, no, I'm not doing that. Like they wanted him to be more of a wizard. But he was a highly regarded actor on the stage and screen. Other credits include The Exorcist 3, The 7% Solution. He plays Sherlock Holmes. This is the film adaptation of the Nicholas Meyer novel. Nicholas Meyer we talked about in terms of Time After Time. We mentioned that he wrote the novel, The 7% Solution, and it was made into the film. Well, this was the Sherlock.
Oh, okay.
He was in, Williamson was also in Robin and Marian. He was in 1969's Hamlet, playing Hamlet. He was in a TV movie version of Mice and Men, playing Lenny. And while very talented on both stage and screen, he was also known to be a bit erratic, was a heavy drinker later in life, and was said to be difficult to work with. So we have Reed, we have Kinski, and we also have Williamson. Though I guess the situation is Reed and Kinski were working together, like they shared so much screen time. And for the most part, Williamson's character is just standing outside, like shouting in, or not even quite shouting. It's one of those movies where his character is using just a normal speaking voice, but can be heard inside a house good distance away.
Yeah, they spend a lot of... there are multiple scenes where they're negotiating, like, we need a car and we need money. And then he goes away and then he has like a meeting with all his little police lieutenants. And then he comes back and they talk again about how they need a car and they need money.
Yeah. I'd say Williamson is good in this, but there's not a lot to this particular character. He's just that sensible British cop on the scene. You know, he's our embodiment of British working class law and order.
Yeah, he's got a nice accent in it. I mean, but this character doesn't have a whole lot to do. Now, the next character, I would say, though, brings a surprising amount of weird energy that also makes this movie come alive, and that is Sarah Miles playing the snake expert Dr. Marion Stowe. I really liked her. She had a certain distracted electricity kind of coming off of her head in all of her scenes, if you know what I mean.
No, she was good in this. Sarah Miles was born in 1941. And another connection to 1966 Blow Up. Miles actually had a major role in this adaptation of Julio Cortazar's story. I can't remember if it was a novella or short story offhand. But anyway, it was adapted into this film in 1966. Other titles on her filmography include Ryan's Daughter, Hope and Glory, White Mischief, and more.
There are a lot of good scenes of her talking to the police about snakes. And so, you know, cop will, she'll just be like, I am a toxicologist. And the cop will be like, what's that, poisons?
Yeah, she's good. The other great performance in this, in my opinion, is our third kidnapper. Who the character is Louise Andrews, played by Susan George. So George was born 1950, probably best known for playing Amy in Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs. Other titles include Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, Mandingo, and Enter the Ninja, as well as Tintoria, Killer Shark, The Sorceress, starring Boris Karloff, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from 1972, a musical starring Kirk Douglas.
Susan George is good in this. Like you say, she's our third criminal in the trio. So you got Kinski, you got Oliver Reed, and you got Susan George, and they're scheming to do this kidnapping plot to get a bunch of ransom money. Of course, the criminals in this movie are bad at crime, so they keep failing. But you can, I don't know. It's fun the way you see her like struggling with things not going their way. And she also, I got to say, really sells a snake bite to the face death scene quite well.
Yes, I would say perhaps the greatest death by snake bite scene in any motion picture. It's a tour de force in which she thrashes around, she cries out, and basically goes just full exorcist towards the end, like, you know, all the way into like wheel pose or, you know, reverse crab or something.
She turns blue. There's a lot of blood coming out of her mouth.
Yeah. So she's a lot of fun. In passing, I'll say that the mother in this, so this would be Grandpa Safari's daughter?
Yeah.
Or is it his daughter-in-law? I can't remember.
No, his daughter.
At any rate, Ruth Hopkins, played by Cornelia Sharp, born 1943, probably best known for Serpico. She also appeared in the reincarnation of Peter Proud, The Next Man, opposite Sean Connery, Open Season, and, hey, The Adventures of Pluto Nash.
She's just sort of in the beginning and the end of this movie, though, because a lot of it's like she's gone and the son has been left there with Grandpa, played by Sterling Hayden, and that's when the crime is supposed to take place.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, it's kind of a Home Alone movie. Mm-hmm. It's weird. I don't know if you had this experience, but I felt like this movie felt like an adaptation of like a Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode that doesn't exist, you know? Like, or maybe it's just that a Treehouse of Horror episode would be perfect based on this film. You could have Grandpa Simpson in there. You have have Bart. And I don't know who else would be involved, who you would cast as our kidnappers.
Oh, yeah. So I guess Snake? Oh, Snake. I mean, let's see. To play for Oliver Reed, he would need to be sort of a cross between Snake and Groundskeeper Willie. Oh, yeah. I don't know exactly how it would work out. So Kinski is sort of Mr. Burns, but I guess he wouldn't need the money. But I don't know. He'd want it anyway. It would work out somehow. Oh, but hey, this movie also has Michael Goff in it.
Oh, yeah. In a strange role because... Okay, so first of all, if you're forgetting who this actor is, it's Alfred from Tim Burton's 1989 Batman film and the Batman sequels through Batman Forever. He's a guy who did a lot of work prior to that, including performances in The Boys from Brazil, Satan's Slave, Crucible of Horror, Trog, Women in Love, Horror of Dracula, and titles going all the way back into the 1940s. And in this, he plays an expert snake catcher who never does anything.
Yeah, he shows up later in the movie. So this movie has multiple snake experts. There's the one played by Sarah Miles, who is the toxicologist, and you meet her early on, but then she eventually also gets taken hostage by the criminals. And then so the police after that are working with this character played by Michael Goff. But he's just got sort of like one of those snake hooks, and he's standing there beside the police as they're trying to bust into the house.
Yeah, and you keep thinking, well, he's going to be called upon for more than his expertise, but no, he's not. The fun part of this, though, is his character's name is David Ball, and the real David Ball, an overseer of reptiles at the London Zoo, was the snake wrangler and snake advisor on this film. So I guess Goff's character is kind of just a nod to his help with the film. I was reading about this in a New York Times article about the snake wrangling in Venom. It was titled, In Venom, the Snake Steals the Show. And it shares a number of interesting production facts.
I love that there is an article in the New York Times in 1982 about Venom that is not just a review of the movie. It's like, our readers need more Venom content.
Yeah, but it does share some fun stuff. Like apparently they shot 10 hours of snake footage for the film. And of course that gets, reduced down to just, very little of that, just minutes of footage. They used 5 different actual black mambas in the picture. So when you see black mambas striking at the camera and slithering about, it's the real thing. It's the real snake. For the most part, they also apparently had one non-venomous rat snake that they used for some scenes. They had plastic snakes made from actual casts of mambas. That's, of course, what Klaus Kinski winds up fighting at the end. And they also had a $100,000 robot snake that apparently looked terrible, so we barely see it in the final film.
Yeah, I think the sentence in the article is something like the robot snake could rear up and open its mouth. It cost $100,000 to make, and it appears for 1/3 of 1 second in the final cut.
Now, according to David Ball in this article, black mambas are very high strung and they feel threatened by anything within 6 feet of them. They have really potent venom and they're very effective at delivering it, usually via multiple bites, which is something we see in the film. And it is a very impressive snake. There's one at Zoo Atlanta, and I've seen it many times. They can reach lengths of 14 feet. Yeah, they tend to be nervous. They pack tremendous venom. It's the largest venomous snake in Africa and the second largest venomous snake in the world, right behind the king cobra. It's not actually black, but the inside of its mouth is black, and that's what it flares as a warning to anyone who makes it nervous.
Now, a bit of monster science on this. The movie repeatedly emphasizes that the black mamba is the most, I think it actually uses the word poisonous. I think you would want to say venomous instead, but mm-hmm. Whichever one they say, poisonous or venomous snake in the world, which, I mean, it's difficult. There are different ways you can measure that, but just by your standard, like pure LD50 ratings of snake venom in mice, this is not true.
I should also point out, as with pretty much any snake, reptile, amphibian sort of movie, it's always worth going to californiaherps.com. They have a section about snake films in which they weigh in on different snakes and different films, and they have an article on venom here, and basically they applaud the use of real black mambas, but they add, quote, oddly enough, the snake doesn't try to get out or hide as you'd expect a snake to do. All it wants to do is kill people.
It just sort of hunts the people in the house. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the most ludicrous things about this movie is that, yes, I totally believe everything I've read about the black mamba being a potentially dangerous snake that you absolutely don't want running around in your house. You wouldn't want to, go poking around haphazardly where you knew they might be. But on the other hand, I mean, it's implied in this film where, like, if you were to call the police and say, there's a black mamba in my house, the police would just be like, we are legally declaring everyone in the house dead because there's yeah. no way you're going to survive.
Yes. Yeah. So though, as you're saying, I do want to reemphasize, given what I said a minute ago, by these like LD50 charts, it is not necessarily the most venomous snake in the world. But as you are correct, that you absolutely don't want to be bitten by one. These are people do die from black mamba bites all the time.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, we don't always mention the cinematographer on films, but on this film, we have Gilbert Taylor, who lived 1914 through 2013. He was the cinematographer on such films as Star Wars, Flash Gordon, The Omen, the Frank Langella Dracula film, Polanski's Macbeth and Repulsion, Hitchcock's Frenzy, Dr. Strangelove, and various other titles. He also did a bit of TV, including episodes of The Avengers.
This movie doesn't really stand out to me in terms of a lot of cinematography choices, but there is something that happens quite a bit, which is Mamba Cam, where you are seeing from the snake's point of view as it like crawls through heating ducts and so, okay, that's fun.
Well, and then, you know, we do have, I guess the shots of the snake often feel very well executed. You know, at times they're basically doing the Raiders thing, I think, where they have some sort of plexiglass screen so that the snake can jump out, can leap at the camera, and you don't have to worry about it actually biting anyone. Mm-hmm. As for the music on this picture, it is Michael Kamen, who lived 1948 through 2003. We've mentioned him on the show before because he scored Free Jack and Tales from the Crypt: Demon Knight, as well as such movies as Highlander, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Brazil, The Dead Zone, Event Horizon, which he did with The Orb. So a known commodity in various genre films. I'd say that the for me anyway, I felt like the score in this movie was traditional. It was fine. It did everything you'd want a score to do. It helped drive home these thrilling moments and snake scares. But other than that, it's not the kind of thing I would want to seek out.
I thought there were some strange choices in terms of scoring, not because the music was bad, but I thought like sort of oddly placed. Maybe we can talk about those a little bit when we break down the plot.
Well, let's go ahead and get into the plot.
All right. So the movie begins with a shot of a schoolhouse, kind of a weird choice for a crime thriller plus snake movie, but I guess, you know, it's about an attempted kidnapping of a rich boy. So we got to see the boy getting out of school. I guess there's an American flag flying out on the balcony in front of the school, but it's clearly in Britain. And we see a sign later saying it's the American Academy of London. So I think this is a school for American children, the children of diplomats and stuff like that, in London. And so Philip is going to the school, and we meet him on the stairs reading a book, and his mom runs up to him saying, "Oh, this is the limit. You'll catch cold." And he's, you know, he's clearly like, "Oh, I don't want to be safe. I don't want to bundle up. I want adventure." So, you know, he's like, "Oh, mom."
I will say that the actor they have playing the boy, Lance Holcomb, he was really good in this. Like, he has kind of a Charlie in the Chocolate Factory sort of vibe to him.
Okay. But so his mom takes him away to a waiting sedan where Oliver Reed is just looming nearby in a comically brutish fashion. Mm-hmm. And I love how the very first time we see him, it's less than a minute into the movie, he is dressed in a formal chauffeur's uniform with a cap and everything. And even in this goobery outfit, he looks, I mean, like he often does, like he just came back in a hurry from doing a series of things that are all illegal. you know, he looks like, oh, he just ran a bunch of errands, including purchasing illegal whale gonads on the black market and like getting into a fight. Like, you know, somebody looked at him wrong and he kicked them in the neck. And now he's back here to drive this kid home. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's got this, even apart from whatever he's acting out in the scene, he just almost always looks kind of sweaty and like he has just been caught or almost been caught doing something he wasn't supposed to.
Yeah, and constantly, like if he were a Dungeons and Dragons character, it would be constantly doing intimidation checks on everybody around him. He's constantly busting out that cold, intimidating stare.
And like I said earlier, there's really no suspense about what's going to go on with this character, because as soon as the mother and son get into the car, we just see Oliver Reed looking at them in the rearview mirror with absolute murder eyes. I mean, he looks like he should be weeping blood. But then, so after that, we just cut to a driving scene. Gotta love a driving scene at the beginning of a movie. So we're just watching the car navigate the streets of London. The title comes up and the music gets all hopeful and peppy. Do you remember this? I thought this was a weird choice because the opening music makes it sound like it's going to be a movie about a jaunty sea voyage and teamwork and friendship.
Yeah, it has strange energy. This was, I think, the point, too, where I really didn't know what the score was going to be, and I was still maybe holding out hope that it would be, you know, electronic or something. And I was like, oh, no, it's not going to be. It's going to be very traditional.
But yeah, whatever they're going for, it has a funny effect. So we get this driving scene at the beginning, Philip and his mom getting driven around London by Oliver Reed. He's just like drilling holes into them through the rearview mirror. And then the music is just rousing strings and brass. It's trying to warm your blood. And then they get home and they meet Louise, the housekeeper. And she's like, "Ah, young Master Philip, 2 whole days off school, eh?" And of course, this is, Louise is played by Susan George. And so we learn a bit about the situation, that these are Americans living in London, that the boy's father has been gone for a while, and that he is there with his mother, Ruth, and his grandfather. And so we learn that Ruth, the mother, has to leave town soon, but young Master Philip wants to go see his zoo. That's what he calls it. He's like, "My zoo." And so what does this mean? Well, he gets up to his room and, oh my God, his bedroom is straight out of Dante's Inferno. It is like a dungeon for small animals. It is just crates and cages stacked up to the ceiling with rabbits and hamsters and God knows what else.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely overdoing it here, in my opinion. But on the other hand, my son has a leopard gecko, and I know that, like, just having a leopard gecko, that means, oh, well, you don't just have a pet leopard gecko, you also have pet crickets. And some people actually go to the level of, like, raising their own crickets. So maybe that's part of what we're seeing here. It's like, well, he's got a bunch of snakes and so forth. Well, that means he's also raising mice.
Oh, I didn't think about that. But so you think the mice in his room are there to feed his snakes?
I don't know, maybe. But then again, yeah, he has things like rabbits in there. So I guess it is just an extended, you know, zoological collection here and not just about feeding the animals.
I keep these rabbits to feed to my pet hyena. Well, anyway, we meet Sterling Hayden. We find out he is Ruth's dad, and he's staying with them, I think, because of some kind of injury. Am I right about that?
I was a little foggy on this. I mean, we've learned that he's, what, some sort of, like, great explorer, safari-type guy.
And a photographer, maybe?
I guess so. You know, he's kind of, you know, the, you know, safari guy in the classic sense, where he's studying, you know, the world and probably writing about it and taking photos. But, but there's a sense that, like, his adventuring days are perhaps over, right?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I think they're trying to give him Ernest Hemingway energy.
Okay. He has enormous shotguns on the wall.
Yes, yes. With, like, shells the size of soda cans. So I think these are meant for elephants or something. After we meet these characters, and of course, the grandpa and Ruth, talk about how she's got to leave town soon and she's worried about leaving the young boy there with him because she's like, oh, he's got asthma. I don't know. It seems like it's going to be fine. So she's like, okay, I got to head out. And then things immediately start getting juicy because we start seeing the conspiracy. Oliver Reed and Susan George, the housekeeper Louise, when they're talking in private, she is washing Ruth's jewelry. That's interesting. Washing the jewelry. I don't know if that's supposed to say something about Ruth being really, really fussy about fancy things or something. But that's what she's doing. And then they're talking about something coming up. They're plotting in secret about something. And Oliver Reed appears to be having misgivings. He's like, look, this isn't just stealing cars. If something goes wrong, they're going to lock us up and throw away the key. And he's wondering, will Jack Mel come through? And Louise assures him, yes, Jack Mel will come through. Now, there was a thing I noticed. I don't know if you noticed this, but as Ruth is leaving the house, she's giving instructions to Louise, and she's saying, okay, while I'm out of town, the house must be kept at no less than 75 degrees, so the heat always turned up to 75 or higher, which, I don't know, maybe my senses are off, but obviously that'd be normal in the summer, but like turning the heat in the winter up to 75, that sounds insanely high.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a little guilty if I set it for 70, you know, and I'll feel really guilty if I'm like, that's it, I'm going up to 71. But even that'll be like, but just for a few minutes, just so I start feeling my toes again, that sort of thing. 75 seems like it would be just like, it'd be like a jungle in there.
Yeah, yeah. Because heater heat feels very different than natural heat. Like if it's 75 degrees outside, that's nice weather. But if it's 75 degrees from a heater, that's like, you know, you're going under the gates. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here.
Well, I think we see, now that I think about it, it looks like it's gas, right? So they're probably just completely dried out in there, which I guess is why we also see the reliance on the humidifiers.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So they keep it at 75, but also the kid sleeps with the humidifier. I think the idea is he's got asthma and the humidifier may be delivering some kind of medication in the steam.
Yeah, because there is that, I would say, effectively creepy scene where we see that Jock Mel, jumping ahead a little bit here, but where Jock Mel checks on the house that they have set up, the place they want to take the boy after they kidnap him, and they have the same machinery there, like they're intended to have like a long stay at the kidnapping house, which was creepy.
Right, but of course they never get to that house because the criminals in this movie are bad at crime. Oliver Reed takes Ruth to the airport, so the mother leaves town. And then at about 11 minutes into the movie, the two devils collide. Oliver Reed meets Jock Mel, who is Klaus Kinski. They meet at the airport. They come face to face. It's clear from the very first moment that they do not like each other, but they're locked into this conspiracy together now.
Yes, and Louise is the sensual glue holding the whole thing together. And of course, that's going to be one of the great complicating situations in the plot, is that she is the one who dies first.
Right, and I think it's implied that she's been having love affairs with both of them.
Right.
Oh, and as soon as they get in the... So they go off to the car, and of course, Oliver Reed has a gun for Jack Mel, and he drops him off at a house in the country that they've rented ahead of time, and this is where they're going to stash the kid while they're holding him for ransom. So we get to see Jack Mel going around the house, pulling the curtains aside, inspecting the rooms, And then Louise shows up at the house and the two of them are conspiring. So Klaus Kinski and Susan George are checking in on how the plot is coming along. And Jacmel says he doesn't trust the chauffeur. He says his hands sweat, which I love. It's like, oh, he's not cool like you.
Yeah. You get the sense that Kinski's character, Jacmel, does not sweat at all.
But so Jacmel lures Sterling Hayden out of the house. I think that they're trying to find a way to get him away so that they can take the kid. And so they lure him away by pretending to be a filmmaker who wants grandpa's help on a film shoot in Central Africa. And he tells him to come meet for a cocktail at the Tower Hotel. But of course, grandpa goes to meet with the filmmaker who will in fact never show up because it's Klaus Kinski just pretending to be somebody else. It's just a ruse to get him out of the house. Meanwhile, Philip is off in a taxi to the pet shop. And here is the scene where things finally really kick off, I think, because he acquires his snake.
Yeah, supposed to get just a normal, non-venomous pet snake. I forget what variety it was supposed to be, but there's a mix-up. The black mamba that is supposed to go to the London Zoological Society or something, that's going to, end up being studied or something. It instead goes to this boy. It's put in a box for Philip, and he is taking it home on a taxi.
Right. So, and then the plot is exposed when we cut to, it's the London Institute of Toxicology, and
that's where
Sarah Miles works. So they're checking on she and a couple of researchers there are checking out their new live specimen of the black mamba. This would be Dendroaspis polylepis. And they're like, no, this isn't the right snake at all. So something's wrong here. And on closer inspection, they discover it is a harmless species of snake commonly sold as a pet. And there must have been some kind of mix up. So they quickly trace this back to, I don't know why they were getting a black mamba from a London pet shop, but they were. And so they trace it back to the pet shop and they realize there must have been a mix up there. And she immediately calls the police. And she's like, hello, I'm calling from the Toxicology Institute. And the policeman is like, toxicology, that's poisons, isn't it? And she explains that there's been this mix up and some kid must have just walked out of the shop with a black mamba. And they really play up the danger of the snake. It is the most deadly thing on the planet. It might as well be a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, I mean, there are moments later in the film where it's like, there's a black mamba upstairs. You should absolutely not go upstairs. Like, going upstairs is just a no-go. You will die if you go up there.
Now, meanwhile, the crime plot is already getting screwed up. As we said, this is a movie about criminals who are quite bad at crime. So Philip was supposed to stay home so Louise could put him in a car with Jacmel, who would kidnap him for ransom. But he didn't stay home. He went to the store to get his snake. So eventually he comes back with his snake and she's frantic and she's like, hello, I need you to get directly into a car with this man who you've never met before and is Klaus Kinski. And the kid is like, no, I will not be doing that. I have to put my snake into its vivarium. So he runs inside to do that. And then Oliver Reed is there and Oliver Reed's just angry. He's angry at this child for failing to be kidnapped.
He's just like insulting the child, which was weird. He's like, he's such a brat or something,
Yeah. It's
like the total outburst.
Yeah. And then Louise chases young Master Philip up to his room where they open the snake box and she is just immediately bitten in the face a bunch of times by the black mamba.
It's a frightening scene too.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the snake slithers away into the shadows. Meanwhile, Sterling Hayden arrives back home. So the ruse, I guess he's given up on waiting for the German filmmaker at the cocktail lounge. He wasn't supposed to be there, but he arrives and Philip's still there. Louise, who's been bitten on the face by the snake a bunch of times, is like, I am dying. And everybody's like, oh, you'll be fine. It's just a harmless house snake. And then Oliver Reed just starts punching Grandpa. And Jacmel points a gun at him and is like, I'm in charge. It is not time to punch Grandpa until I say it's time to punch Grandpa. So they lock Sterling Hayden in the cellar, and then we see Oliver Reed loading a gun. And this is the one you were talking about earlier. Like, it must be an elephant gun or something because the shells are enormous. And then the badness at crime just continues. Like, a policeman arrives and knocks at the door, I guess because the toxicology lab figured out that this is the address of the boy who accidentally took home the super snake. And the policeman knocks. Philip shouts for help from inside the house. And then the officer opens the front door to just see this tableau of Oliver Reed holding a shotgun, Klaus Kinski clutching a terrified child, Susan George with her face turning purple and she's gasping for air, and then Oliver Reed just shoots the police officer and the kid. And so, like, everything is screwed up now. So now they are in the house having shot a police officer outside, and they are not going to escape to their hiding place with the kid for ransom. Now they're just in the house with the cops outside, and it's a siege.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, so at this point, we're very much in, like, they say the best laid plans of mice and men and go astray. This was not a very well laid plan, and it has definitely gone astray. But this is a common feature in a lot of crime shows and crime stories. You know, it's like the heist doesn't go as it's supposed to, and now we have to deal with the consequences of that. And then here come the police. That's going to be our next big movement in the plot. And I will say that one of the things I liked about the film that I thought made it very watchable is that it has very strong procedural bones, you know? Mm. You're laying out, like, what the poorly thought out criminal enterprise seems to be, like what their plan is. And then there's a lot in the film about the police officers responding and getting advice and trying to figure out, like, what is the proper strategic move to make. And it really helps to, you know, drive the film along in a way that I thought was ultimately entertaining. Like, I was reading Ebert's review of the film, and Ebert was like, despite all these actors, this film's boring. And I disagree. I don't think this film is ever boring. It falls short in some notable areas, but it's never boring.
Oh, I'd agree. And yeah, you're right about the procedural stuff. Wait, you made this comparison off mic. Did you say it on mic that it's kind of like Shin Godzilla in that regard?
Yeah, it's kind of like the Shin Godzilla of loose snake movies.
Uh-huh.
In that, you know, there's a lot of, well, let's talk to the expert and see what they think we should do. Okay, let's talk to another expert. What did they think? And so forth.
Shin Godzilla is the best movie ever made about meetings. And this is a very good movie about, yeah, little strategy sessions where people are talking out their next plans. Oh, I should have mentioned, after all that last stuff happens, like around the, you know, one third of the way into the movie, Louise dies. So, you know, They thought she'd just been bitten by this harmless house snake, but then she turns completely blue. There's blood coming out of her mouth and she's dead. And the other crime boys are like, ooh, whoops, maybe there is something bad about this snake. Mm-hmm. And so then the police arrive, and this is when we really meet Nicole Williamson. He arrives, he sets up outside, he's trying to do negotiations with Jack Mel. These negotiations will continue for throughout the middle third of the movie. Of course, Klaus Kinski, he wants a car and money in exchange for the kid's safety, and they're not going to get that yet. So the Act Two setup is complete. And from here, it goes on to a lot of, you know, the standard fun and games part of a creature movie, where there's a lot of Mamba cam and, like, hunting around for the snake. They send Grandpa up to hunt for the snake, and he's holding, like, a lamp with the shade taken off.
Mm-hmm. And there are some false positives in his search for the snake that I think work pretty well on the screen.
But he knows what it is, because he's, you know, from all his safari experiences, he's familiar with black mambas and the fact that they can be dangerous. So he's like, okay, we're really in trouble with this thing in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one scene I thought was pretty good was the one with Sterling Hayden hunting around for the snake in the empty room.
I wonder if this is perhaps something that maybe worked better in the book, like if the book allowed the author more room to sort of ruminate over, like, tales of the Mamba from Africa that Grandpa would be familiar with, and maybe Grandpa thinking about, like, just how intensely dangerous the situation is. Like, maybe it was able to drive home this idea of the Mamba being such a threat in ways that the film maybe struggled to do at times.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we know about the Mamba in the movie gets filled in by these scientists. So, like, at around, there's a lot of the sort of cat and mouse games in the middle third of the movie. And somewhere like an hour in, there's this meeting between Nicole Williamson and Marion Stowe, the snake scientist. And this is where they talk about, you know, he's like, how dangerous is it? Because she's finally gotten the information to him that there's a killer snake inside. And she says it's the most dangerous snake in the whole world. But she gives it all these sort of anthropomorphic qualities. She says, like, they're very aggressive, but they tend to be a little awkward, paranoid, really. She says they happen to be the fastest snake in the world. And she says, unless the bite victim gets antidote immediately or anti-venom immediately, Mamba bites are 100% fatal. But she says if you get the antidote to the venom, it's a 50-50 chance, provided that the victim is not allergic to it.
I'll go ahead and mention again that California Herp's website reminds us that there are some suspect Mamba facts in this movie. So don't watch Venom just for your education on black Mambas. Go to other sources.
Right. But also, I mean, it is certainly true that the black Mamba is one of the more dangerous snakes on Earth in terms of interactions with humans. Like, if you see one, don't go anywhere near it. You know, that thing, it probably doesn't want anything to do with you, but you do not want to be bitten by it.
Right. But can it smell crime? Does it own the night? I mean, these are questionable.
Yeah. Now, there's a fun scene where they send out Sarah Miles to deliver a snake science lecture to the people in the house. So, you know, the house is besieged by cops, and she just goes out in front of it to, like, tell them about the Mamba and its venom. So they do keep saying poisonous snake, by the way. The pedantic part of my brain couldn't let that go. And through some devious trickery, Klaus Kinski eventually manages to get the snake scientist or the toxicologist, Dr. Stowe, into the house by pulling a gun on her. He tricks her into thinking that she can administer an antidote to someone who has been bitten, but really it's just him pointing a gun in her face. So she's a hostage now as well.
Love how basically Jacques Mel is approaching this situation. It's like, what got us into this problem? Kidnapping. Uh-huh. What will get us out of this situation? More kidnapping.
Right, exactly. And so there's a bunch of stuff with the police scheming about maybe back entrances to the house. This, I think, is part of the Shin Godzilla quality you were talking about, little strategy sessions where they're like consulting the building plans of the house. They're like, there used to be a back entrance. We could maybe bust through there. And then meanwhile, inside the house, there's a great scene where everybody's just sitting around. It's Oliver Reed and Sarah Miles, and Oliver Reed's like, I'm thirsty. I fancy a drink. How about you?
Yeah, and I love this moment because Reed's character, Dave, he kind of enters into this comfort zone offering the drink, and he's listing all the different liquors that are available, and he's like, we've got most things. Mm-hmm. It puts you completely at ease because then when he opens up the drink cabinet and you find yourself just, you know, like, oh, well, I want to see these bottles. You know, I am curious. Maybe I'll have a drink too, Oliver.
He's going to make a white Russian, yeah.
But then he opens it up, and what is in the liquor cabinet but the Mamba?
There you go. It's a snake pop-out scare. It's a great snake pop-out scare, I got to say. I really enjoyed it.
It is.
And the special horror of, like, Oliver Reed realizes that the snake is in there with the alcohol.
Yeah, at first I thought that was going to be the thing. It's almost like a Simpsons moment, like, oh no, the beer is locked up with the snake. No one can get the beer now, that sort of thing. But then, yeah, there's this scene where they then pull the liquor cabinet away from the wall, and we see the snake slither through like a crack in the back of the liquor cabinet into the wall.
It's a duct.
Did you understand this?
There is a duct. I did not know. I think I understood what I was looking at, but... So it's not like built into the wall. It's a liquor cabinet that is a separate piece of furniture. It's like a chest or a wardrobe kind of thing almost. As a cabinet opens up, it's got all the liquor inside. But there is a hole in the back of it where there's a duct leading into the wall, like connecting it. I don't know. I don't know what that was supposed to be or if that's normal. I mean, do you normally have a duct going from the wall to a separate piece of furniture containing liquor bottles?
I can't imagine you would. But then again, it's necessary for this scare to work because otherwise, the snake is just stuck in the liquor cabinet now. And okay, he's in there. Well, now we've won. Now we can just nail the liquor cabinet shut. No, it gets away. It's back in the walls. It goes wherever it wants to in this house.
Now, so the police are scheming about ways to breach the house to get in there and save the hostages. But I think the funny thing is that ultimately the police fail in this regard, and it is the snake, in fact, that defeats the criminals.
Yeah, the snake is ultimately the hero of the picture, dispensing with all three kidnappers and never, I mean, threatening, I guess, but never actually harming any of the non-criminals in the picture.
Yeah, it's a lawful good snake.
Can smell crime, I think.
Yes. I don't know how much detail we want to go into about the particular demise of Oliver Reed or Klaus Kinski's characters. Oliver Reed, they're like down in the basement, and suddenly the police bust in through the wall and and they're having a standoff. They're shooting at each other, but then there's a snake, and the police are like, "Snake!" And they have to run away and go back out the the breach in the wall. It was like you were more scared of the snake than the gun.
I know, it's like a xenomorph in this thing. Reed's character Dave is shot. He's like shot in the shoulder, so he's heavily injured. He can't quite crawl up the stairs, and that's when the Mamba comes for him.
In a quite gratuitous scene of like creature revenge against human evil, Oliver Reed is bitten in the crotch by the snake, and
yep, succumbs. Goes right up the pants leg.
Yeah,
and now it's just Jacques Mel.
Right, but I'm imagining like the writing that scene. It was, you know, like what did that look like on the page? The snake slithers slowly up his thigh.
Oliver Reed's great in this scene, though. He totally sells it.
But then, of course, the snake in the end also has to attack the one remaining criminal, Jacques Mel. We see it like creeping up through curtains behind him as the music builds. Yep. And then it springs out and attacks him. And literally, like, the final conflict of the movie is Klaus Kinski wrestling a snake and engaging in a gunfight with a snake.
Yeah, like thrashing around in the upstairs living room or whatever it happens to be. Trying to shoot the snake's head off with his own gun. Eventually, the fight goes out onto the balcony, and the whole time, like, it's clearly a rubber snake. Mm-hmm. It's Kinski battling this rubber snake. And then, especially when he fires the gun, that's when the snipers start firing, the police snipers start firing. So Kinski's character and the snake die in a hail of bullets and then fall off the balcony. My only criticism is that the body does not become impaled on the spiked fence at the bottom. That I think would have made it a little more perfect, but maybe they thought that would just be overdoing it. I don't know.
I thought it should have ended with the snake slithering down Klaus Kinski's throat and biting him from the inside.
Like going right to the heart.
Yeah. It coils around his heart and bites it 100 times.
But basically, that's the big finish. Now all of the kidnappers are dead. The Black Mamba itself is dead, and everybody is safe once again. Or are they?
Oh, that's right, because we get a delightful stinger in which you go into the heating ducts and you see some eggs, some snake eggs up in there. I guess they're being incubated by the gas heat.
Not only that, they've hatched. There's like a baby Mamba crawling out of one. So it's not only Mamba time once more in this house, but it's also going to be like double Mambas. So, you know, set up for the sequel here, I guess.
Is that like it's Miller time? It's Mamba time?
Yeah. I mean, they could have done a sequel. I mean, they were able to make all those Taken movies. I think you could come up with another scenario in which you have kidnappers or terrorists or something taking over the house.
The exact same family, the exact same house, and it's two snakes this time.
Two snakes, yeah.
Okay, who would have to play the criminals in the sequel? It would be how about Gary Busey and Robert Mitchum?
Ooh, yeah. Was Robert Mitchum still alive at that point? Can't remember when he died.
1997.
Okay, yeah, he could have done it. Sure. I don't know. I don't know if I want to see like mid-80s Robert Mitchum wrestling a snake, though. I don't know.
I want to see that.
At any rate, it never came to be. We never got a sequel to Venom. Like I say, I feel like it is a movie that is essentially ludicrous. Like the premise at the center of this movie is just ridiculous. I mean, the idea that this snake is just so dangerous and wants to kill people, wants to kill criminals or anybody that gets near it. It's just ultimately, I never really bought it in the film, you know? I'm quick to give something credit if it works within the context of the film, and this never quite did that. But we still have some great snake scares. We have some fun performances, and we have this procedural energy kind of driving things along. All right. Well, you're probably wondering, well, where can I watch Venom? Well, lucky for you, it's widely available for digital rental or purchase. And also Blue Underground put out a nice looking Blu-ray of it as well with a restored 2K transfer. So you can watch this movie yourself via those means. Also, I'll stress again, the novel is out there in digital and physical form. So, I would love to hear from anyone who's read the novel Venom and can chime in on it. And you might be wondering, well, I haven't read it, but could I read it and then tell Rob and Joe what it's all about and give my review? Yes, you can absolutely do that. I would love to have some insight into the novel that came before here.
Now, wouldn't it be great if Venom was one of those films that had a novel and then a movie and then a novelization of the movie separate from the original novel?
Oh, yeah, you see that sometimes. For me, the most notable example being Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, in which, of course, it is an adaptation of Dracula, but there is also a novelization of the film.
Genius.
Yeah, which I always found outrageous, because it's not like Dracula, the original, is an unreadable text. Like, did it really need to be updated, in terms of the written version? I don't know.
It was so it could say, Jonathan Harker, who looked like the American actor Keanu Reeves, arrived in, where does he go? I don't, Budapest or...
Oh, doesn't Dracula have a mustache in the original Bram Stoker's Dracula? Maybe that was it.
In the movie or in the novel?
In the novel.
I don't recall how he's described.
I could be wrong on that. But wouldn't it have been funny, though, if they were like, okay, standard operating procedure, we need a novelization of this film, and they assign it to somebody, and what if they just turned in a copy of Bram Stoker's Dracula? and they're like, it was such a great adaptation. Like, as it worked out, the novelization of the film is the original novel.
That's just smart, yeah.
I didn't even realize that I had completely reproduced the original Bram Stoker's Dracula. I was just adapting the film.
Well, if you're going to do it with any film, I will say the Coppola adaptation is unusually faithful to the novel, much more so than most other adaptations I can think of.
Yeah, and also has some really fun performances in it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close the liquor cabinet on this serpent. But we will be back with other episodes of Weird House Cinema. They publish every Friday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We're primarily a science and culture podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We have listener mail on Mondays and artifact episodes. Those are shorties on Wednesdays.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.